Out of bed at 8 a.m, out my head by 10:30. Out with mates and dates and friends, that's what I do at weekends. Hello and welcome to Big Mouth, your discerning pop culture podcast for people who are going down the Locarno later on. See you there. I'm Sian Pattinson, and while Andrew Harrison, the nice seat to my smashy, suns himself for yet another week in the street smart cribs of downtown Hawaii, we're here in the Soho bunker with a Bunsen burner, a packet of KP nuts and a can of pineapple Fanta, recreating the climate for our two fabulous guests. He's worked for Word Magazine, a fair few of those popped through the door, plus Melody Maker, Mixmag, amongst many, many others. Now he's a bigwig at Spotify, where he commissions shows and podcasts and the like. It's Rob Fitzpatrick. Hello, how are you?
Hello, hello, Sian. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good.
How is Spotify?
Spotify's very good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Not ripping off artists anymore?
Not ripping off artists anymore, no.
I hear you have an anti-hierarchical holocracy going on as a business model. Does this mean you just all sit around on beanbags and make each other's coffee and everything's really cool and groovy?
Yeah, basically. It just means that we are on beanbags playing table tennis and drinking smoothies.
And you sort of flip V's at the boss because there's no boss.
Yeah, well, he's just said, hey, this is like, this is the time when you can, we've built in this time into your schedule so you can come around and flick the V's at me. And then sometimes we'll get onto Google Hangouts and flick V's at people in other countries.
Oh, nice.
As well.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, we'll have a kind of, we'll have a group hang.
Yeah.
And just, there'll be a lot of V flicking. Yeah.
And do you meet people who work for YouTube and talk about, you know, the business model?
I don't know what YouTube is.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Never heard of it.
Yes, I understand. What have you been working on recently? There's some shows you've been doing.
Yeah, I am working on a big documentary about a rock band that launches next year in February. So that has been taking up a lot of my time.
And can also, you give us any clues as to who the big rock
they
band
are an
is?
English rock band that are no longer in existence, and they haven't been for quite a few years, but they are a hugely influential rock band from the West London area.
Oh God.
It's not 5-star, is it?
No, that's what I was
they're
thinking.
Like 5-star.
They're like 5-star. Like we'll leave it at that. Fantastic. Yeah. Do you miss music writing? Ha, 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 ha. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's really well paid, isn't it?
Yeah. That's a really good question, because actually sometimes I do, and then other times I think, I don't know where I would do it anymore.
Right.
I don't think that...
Which organ?
Yeah, yeah, which organ? And I don't... I think that I was at the kind of death rattle of the great golden era of music magazines when there were tons. Right? Mm. I mean, I wrote for tons and tons, and most of them are closed, and it's not all my fault. But I don't know. You know, it's like you're going to write for the broadsheets, and who else is there?
Mm. Is there a place, do you think, for a Spotify magazine? She wondered.
Oh, well, interestingly, when I first started at Spotify back in the 1850s, I used to actually write interviews with people on Spotify. And, of course, we looked at the stats one day and literally no one read them. I mean, no one read them.
Right.
So I think there's writing, but there's certainly other ways of having artist voices and artist content in there.
Mm-hmm. I think people are less interested in words now. I think they're quite like pictures.
Like pictures. Yeah, just a picture. A picture like that. Good. Next one.
Yeah. Now, our next guest is Hannah Verdier. She writes, is it Verdier or Verdier?
Verdier.
Verdier, wonderful. It's so exotic around here.
Yeah.
It is, Andrew, it is. She writes about telly for The Guardian, where she immerses herself in future classics such as Love Island, which I think we should sometimes do here. Mm. You also, Hannah, write about podcasts. And you're the graduate of the University of Smash Hits.
Indeed I am. Good morning.
A little bit like me.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Now, you've been on... Rival podcast. Now that's what I call a podcast, I believe it's called. And you were with Howard Jones from Out of the 80s.
Well, you know, I don't like to name drop, but I was sitting there with Mark Goodyear. And I've been doing more podcast guesting than writing lately. And let me tell you, I love it.
Well, you don't have to transcribe it for a start.
Exactly. Yeah. You don't have to get to that boring bit when you've... No, not boring. I'm not being ungrateful, but... You've interviewed a band of five separately and you're at the same question and you're trying to write it up.
Yeah.
I just like chatting.
Even worse, like they all want to be interviewed together.
Oh, yes. And then you have to say, can you just say your name so that I know if you're which Backstreet Boy you are?
Name badges.
Terrifying.
That would always be good. How was Howard Jones? That's obviously really what I want to know.
I'm really sorry to disappoint you, but I didn't actually get to meet him. Oh. I was just in the studio, but he sounded in fine fettle. Mm-hmm. That's all I can say.
Do you think he still has his gimp, is what I always want to know.
Howard Jones's gimp? Why had I forgotten about that?
How could you
and the
miming.
I'm imagining, yeah, he's sitting on the phone doing your podcast, the gimp sort of doing washing up in the background.
Yeah. Casting definitely. Off his mental chains.
You also wrote about stools in rock, the chair type.
Yes, yeah, I did. That was, I think that was my career high this year, really. with the return of Westlife, you have to consider the stool, the chair, even the sofa as it is now.
Oh. Wow.
It was a full investigation.
Is sofas a thing in pop?
Dua Lipa's used a sofa, so I think it's like the new stool. Which was the new chair, but then stools go back to the 60s, obviously.
Of course. They may go back even further than that.
Do you think?
You also identified the perv stool, which I thought was... Tell us about who uses the perv stool.
Wendy's perv stool. Wendy of Wendy and Lisa in the Kiss video. I love the way... Wendy and Lisa are my heroes in everyday life anyway. And Wendy just sits on the perv stool, raising an eyebrow, while Prince gyrates around her, and she just looks so bored. And like, how could you look so bored? But she's probably used to it.
Yeah, she probably got quite a lot of that.
she gets a lot of it.
Wonderful. Let's get on. What have we got on the show today, you ask? Well, Vic and Bob are back for their big night out. It's the 90s again. Will it be a hammer to the jaw of comedy on TV, as it was in the first series? And Michael Douglas stars in and executive produces The Kominsky Method, which is out now from Out of Netflix. I'm sure it was the name of a 1990s easy listening project as well, but I'll get to that later. This series is about an ageing acting coach in LA man who languorously navigates old man stuff like funerals and hospitals. Is it Curb Your Enthusiasm light? And we get introspective as we stare mournfully into our cider and black and listen to the reissue of This Mortal Coil's 3 albums on 4AD. It'll end in tears, filigree in shadow and blood. Happy titles there. We record an extra bit now for subscribers every week. It's new, exclusive and really, really good. And you, yes, you can get a little bit of this if you back us on crowdfunding platform Patreon. Do help us cover our studio costs by pledging the equivalent of the price of a pint every month or one bottle of basic but drinkable wine. And we will send it to you every week just after Big Mouth comes out. Search Patreon Big Mouth, which doesn't sound like a Dickens character anymore. It sounds like someone's uncle from Little House on the Prairie. Patreon Big Mouth. Or go to the Big Mouth Facebook page to find out more. All we're saying is buy us a pint. Right then, still seemingly on the outskirts of popular entertainment, Vic Reeves and Bob Mortimer return with Big Night Out. After their one-off last Christmas, Vic and Bob are back with a series proper. To get us in the mood before we chat about it, here's Vic Reeves' Oh, Mr. Hairdresser, a tune from his 1991 album I Will Cure You. So, fresh as they ever were, Big Night Out starts, of course, with a song and includes typos in the titles, Vic Reeve and Bill Mortimer. There are familiar characters, Mulligan and O'Hare, and Novelty Island's irritable loser, Graham Lister. Even a cameo of sorts from Tom Cruise. But is it any cop? Hannah, were you excited to hear that Vic and Bob were going to be back and do their old stuff?
I was really excited because you get Shooting Stars, you get Cataract, you get all manner of things, but unless it's Big Night Out, it's not the original Vic and Bob. But then I started to read the interviews with them where they said they were approaching 60 and talked about their arthritis a lot. So that did temper my enthusiasm a little bit.
In what way? Did you feel that the arthritis was going to, stop the comedy?
Nothing against the arthritis, but I just get that midlife feeling that Vic and Bob were your student duo, weren't they? Mm. And if they're approaching 60, where does that leave the rest of us?
Right. What did you think of the first ep?
I thought it was half an hour ridiculous, them fooling round. They delivered. Graham Lister was with an owl that goes on the command Shakira. I mean, it's what you need. Mm. But I wasn't particularly excited about it either. Mm-hmm. It was same old thing, but slightly weaker for me. And I feel awful saying that because in particular, I love Bob Mortimer. Mm. but it was okay. I raised a few laughs, but I think it's mostly catchphrase based from back in the day. So, and you can recycle that, and people are just waiting for them to, you know, go to Novelty Island, really. But I wasn't overjoyed by it.
Right, Rob, were you pleased to hear that they were back and they were going to bring something new from out of Big Night Out?
I was pleased to hear that they were back. And, you know, it's always nice that people have got work, right, and they're doing something good. But I agreed with Hannah completely that I was more interested in the idea of watching it than I was about watching any more of it. So it was enjoyable to sit there and go, oh, Vic and Bob, but within a few minutes, there's a sense that they're sort of going back, but they're only going half back.
Right.
And so it's not, they could have just gone balls out and done a greatest hits show, and that would have sort of been funny. It would have maybe been funnier, but it was the problem. And this is a subject I'm sure we're going to touch on further along in the show. But there's the problem with it is that you can't divorce how you felt about it in 1990 and 1991 than how you feel about it now.
Mm.
And in 1990, 1991, those shows as a 20-year-old, I watched them and thought, this is like unbelievably hilarious and revolutionary and wild and mad.
Mm.
But watching it as a 108-year-old, you go, I get it, but I don't know whether it would be possible for it to touch you in the same way as it did.
Right.
I think it's a very difficult task to redo something like that, which is so wrapped up in who you were and what you were then and what the culture was then.
Yes.
To try and revisit that later on is incredibly hard.
I wonder if they were saying, we are essentially the same people. We may be older, but we haven't changed. Look, we can do the same sort of surreal jokes.
Yes.
It seemed very similar to me to the 90s. Now, I have to admit, I never really got it. I thought, well, it's all right, but I didn't find it funny.
But first time round,
oh, yeah. Right. Whereas I really loved Catterick, I like Shooting Stars, but I think some of the weirdest Afternoon Delights I thought was funnier than anything I'd seen them do before, and that was on such a small scale. That them coming back to this and them, you know, they're taking on the mantle of Vic and Bob, they're being those characters. Mm. I don't know how interesting that gets to me. What I find really interesting is when Vic and Bob do the start stuff and Vic is talking to Bob, and there's clearly this power dynamic, and there's the interesting thing that he's the boss, Vic's the boss, and Bob is playing this child and sort of trying to get around it. But then they just stop, and you know, it's very stop-start, and something else comes in, a Tom Cruise character comes in, or they switch to a pre-recorded skit, and I just thought, well, it's just losing me. It keeps losing me.
Mm. I actually watched the trailer for it, which was their greatest hits over the years, like you say, and I was laughing, and I'd forgotten about all the catchphrases and everything, and I started laughing, but I didn't really laugh as much watching it. And I wonder what today's 20-year-olds think of it, whether it offers anything to a new audience as well.
Yeah, I tried to get my 14-year-old son to watch it and I couldn't get him away from Xbox and, and you know, hip-hop long enough to get him to watch it. But the idea of just sitting down in front of the telly for half an hour to watch something was just like, it's not going to happen.
That's so intriguing, isn't it?
But I think it's... I thought that I agree with you, Sian, that the best parts of it were when they were kind of exploring the lunacy between them two. And the least effective parts were when it was like putting some mud in a bag. I mean, it's like, it's fun, I get it, but it's like,
Because
actually those two together are the most, you know, their dynamic is the most interesting thing.
I think you put it right. That's the dynamic that I'm interested in. The singing yodeling bottom. I did feel that I've seen quite a lot of singing yodeling bottoms now. And here was another one. And as you say, you know, it's a bit fair play to your gov. You're still, you know, they're still going. I mean, it's not Val Dunican, is it, quite? However, hip-hop stars with their pants down.
Yeah, I was... What did you think? Did that send a shiver up your spine?
I it left me cold more than the shiver. They have very small penises, if we're allowed to say that. I mean, I thought that was probably the joke, wasn't it? And there were obviously Vic's, Jim's drawings, and I think his art is actually really interesting, and maybe actually more interesting than this. But I thought, well, yeah, we get the joke. They're a bit inflated, these egos of the hip-hop stars. What did you think, Hannah? Did you think that was kind of, hey, pop culture, where were the kids?
Yeah, it kind of left me cold, really. It looked like a bit of a try.
Yeah.
I thought you couldn't help but think, if someone just clipped this out and stuck it on Twitter, you'd have someone somewhere will be outraged by that and
yes.
say,
yeah.
this is like, you know, and I'm not agreeing with them or disagreeing with them, but it's not, you know, it's indicative of the fact that it's not 1991, right?
Mm.
And that there's a sort of panoply of ideas and attitudes that aren't necessarily tuned into a very specific form of comedy that Vic and Bob do, which is that kind of very English kind of psychedelic whimsy in a way, but also, you know, and it's difficult, but ultimately you just can't, it's impossible for me to watch that and not recall being a very stoned 20-year-old thinking nothing will ever be funnier than this.
Right.
And then being a very sober old person thinking,
The audience are very young, aren't they, in the filmed audience that we see, and they're all killing themselves laughing. And I'm wondering if they're the actual audience. It's not really people of their 40s up that are going to see the live shows. I don't know that if I was 20, I would...
I don't know. I never really watched any of those. I was never really a Shooting Stars or Catrick. I'd sort of tuned out by that point, but... it would be interesting. I mean, it'll be interesting to see what the take up on it is, because presumably they want people who aren't, you know, anchored to something that happened nearly 30 years ago.
Mm. I like the fact there's still owls in it. There's Spam.
Yes.
There's comedy tropes that are always funny. An owl is always funny. Spam is always funny. They know what comedy is, and I can see them try to deconstruct it. But
I think, like you say, this isn't probably the era to mock a yodeling bottom and have a small penile. I don't know, it's just not...
Then again, maybe it is.
Maybe it is. I don't know, maybe we need to go back round to that.
The peeling a tangerine section, I thought that... I mean, I lolled at points. Absolutely lolled. But, you know, I don't know whether I'd go back and watch the rest of it.
Well, there are four in the series, so it's not too much of a slog.
That's not much of a commitment, is it?
It's not.
I might invest then.
Yeah. Maybe
it's only a couple of hours.
Yeah.
We always ask our guests to choose a tune for the show. Oh, look, Hannah's lugged in an enormous flight case filled with vinyl. What have you brought in, Hannah?
Let me just have a rummage.
Oh, go on then.
I've bought something from the new album from those young whippersnappers, the 1975. And the track I've bought is... See, I can't say this because it looked like Toot Me at the beginning, which is a whole other board game.
Yeah.
Yes.
Two Time, Two Time, Two Time, which, as Matt Healy explains, it's just a fun song. It doesn't really mean anything. And it's a big old wig out shakedown, and I like it.
Is this the sort of thing you're going to be dancing to at the Christmas disco?
It's at my kitchen Christmas disco. I might slip it on, yes.
Yay. All right, let's have a listen. The 1975, and on to more ghostly matters. 1984 saw the first album from this mortal coil, conceived and produced by one-time 4AD founder Ivo Watts-Russell, which basically co-opted everyone who'd ever been on 4AD records, made them really, 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 really sad, then shoved them in the studio. And it was 34 years ago, the first one, which makes us really, really old. The final and third album came out in 1991, and they've all had the remaster treatment, and they're on beautiful, glossy vinyl. Before we chat, this is You and Your Sister, the Big Star song, with Kim Deal and Tanya Donnelly from the album Blood. You say my love for you is not real. But you don't know how real it feels. All I want to do is to spend some time with you. So the album features the likes of Liz Fraser from Cocteau Twins, Dead Can Dance, Howard DeVoto, Colourbox, Wolfgang Press, Heidi Berry, and on and on and on. All the people who are in the kitchen at parties. And yet, disparate as they are, it sounds so This Mortal Coil, like it's been smothered in coal, draped in chiffon and given a swan to hug. Rob, were you an introverted, lace-covered fan of 4AD and This Mortal Coil in your youth?
I was your textbook goth.
Ooh.
I was absolutely all in black, dyed black hair, crimped, everything.
Probably what kind of level of hair are we talking about?
Oh, like, you know, like proper big, like, yeah.
Big,
big
Robin Guthrie.
I invested in that look.
Okay. The Robert Smith we're going into?
Yeah,
the
definitely.
Full Wayne Hussey, I can imagine.
Yeah, ooh. But this is sort of pre-Wayne. I was probably what you would refer to as like a second wave goth that came in around about 85.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so for me, it was all about kind of Sisters of Mercy and Cure and things like that. However, in relation to... See, I think just quickly, a quick point about that is that obviously, as I was a teenage goth, I hung out with a lot of other teenage goths and none of them were miserable.
I thought teenage goths don't hang out with anyone.
They keep in their tribe, don't they?
Well, no, but there were lots of people in that tribe. We had rockabillies in that tribe. Yeah. I mean, they're just people that, you know, weren't into all the music I like now. But there was nobody was miserable.
Yep. They did happy goths.
Yeah, just we're just like you're just teenagers and it's just the fun, right?
Yeah.
It's just like
fashion?
But it's like I think that but that idea that it's like you're listening to really sad music and therefore you're really sad is just I don't know. It didn't work like that for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It was like I relentlessly listened to bleak music. I still love bleak music, but I've always found bleak music really kind of uplifting.
Mm-hmm. And did you go back to this, listening to these three albums? Did it all come back to you? The hair, the happiness?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, but the then again, you know, and this is another sort of point about this is at that time, certainly 1984, I would have known, I was probably listening to Cocteau Twins and things like that, but I wouldn't have gone out and bought a This Mortal Coil album because this is a part of a whole much wider theory, but you didn't... It was pretty rare that people would have this stuff, right? You know, you'd have to be quite a sort of serious record buyer to have This Mortal Coil, and even more so for things like the stuff that they're, you know, some of the covers on there, like, you know, sort of Big Star and, you know, Alex Chilton stuff and Tim Buckley and things like that. People just didn't have these records. You couldn't hear them, you know, so... Often you would find that was probably the first time you'd ever heard an Alex Chilton song or a Tim Buckley song. It's just that stuff wasn't around, you know, unless you had to be an even more of a kind of super purchaser to go out and have even heard of Tim Buckley, you know, if you were a kind of goth in Epsom in 1986, 1985, you know, I mean, it's just it wasn't, you know, Echo and the Bunnymen was about as far out as it got.
Right.
You know?
Hannah, are you far too young to have been around when This Mortal Coil released their first album?
Sadly, no, not teen. At all. Around that time, I was wearing out Purple Rain and I was very much into the soul music of the time. So
yes.
I'm as far from a This Mortal Coil fan as you can get.
Mm-hmm. So what was it like listening to this stuff in 2018 and thinking this existed when I was listening to, you know, well, the Purple Perv? Yeah.
Well, it was raining that day when I was listening to it, so that kind of added to the mood. I found it a difficult listen, but I think really I had that preconceived idea that I would. But then as I got into it, I think the first album really left me cold.
Right.
But then... I think on Blood, in comes Kim Deal and Tanya Donnelly doing You and Your Sister. Mm. And I was like, oh, right, now I see those moments and Alison Limerick mourning through Judy Collins' My Father as well. And I was like, oh, right, I see. And I think the last one kind of got... I could feel a little bit more liveliness to it. Mm. And I was reading about how Ivor Watts-Russell put all the effort into making sure that all four sides of the album... flowed, and you can hear that in it as well. I don't think I'd rush back particularly to listen to it apart from the odd one or two songs, but I can appreciate it.
Can you see from looking from 2018 back that 4AD world, which is something that I had forgotten about really, that how their philosophy and the 4AD thing was very much similar to a precursor to Factory, Blue Note, where the sleeves... the sleeve notes, the bands, the whole architecture of it is a cohesive, massive whole. They also had Vaughan Oliver doing every single sleeve, who worked with Ivo Watts-Russell. And Vaughan Oliver said in an interview about things, about his creative process, "Man, the first thing I ever wrote on a toilet wall was the words, 'To suggest is to create, to describe is to destroy.'"
And same I just here.
Thought, we all go through that, yes. But that's what really flooded back, is those the record companies and the indies that had, you know, such a world that they created, almost impermeable sometimes. Rob, did you get that feeling? Did that flood back for you?
Yeah, I mean, it did. It is of its time, you know. I mean, and just the music that was being made. I mean, I think that there's a real journey through the three. I can't believe I've just said the real journey, through, but I did.
So too late.
Own it. I know, right? I'm gonna get off my stool for the key change. I mean, they're all really different, and they, you know, and that suggests not only the, you know, the differing sort of musicians that are on it, but also the fact that this, what was a tiny indie label in 1984, had become a huge deal by 1993. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, you know, it sounds bigger and richer. And also there's many, many other influences that have come in by that point. But through it all, I mean, there's some amazing stuff on there. I mean, I haven't, you know, I've not listened to It'll All End in Tears in a long time. But there's some stuff on there that really like, you know, got me, like... Waves Become Wings, which is the Lisa Gerrard and sort of Deck and Dance on, which is like almost kind of odd and sort of new age music, which is one of my key loves. But and then there's also like Strength of Strings, which is a Gene Clark cover, which just sounds like the Bee Gees. It's a sort of big kind of, but you know, like late 60s Bee Gees rather than late 80s Bee Gees. But there's a really, really interesting thing. And I developed this theory while listening to, I mean, I haven't listened to so much This Mortal Coil as I have in the last 3 days ever. But there's also, if you look at the covers, there's these three women on the cover. There's a woman on each cover. And the first one, I thought that was like, what you would like your college girlfriend to look like.
Yeah.
The second one looked like someone that you'd had a sort of horrendous breakup with, having tried out adulthood and found it's quite difficult.
Yes.
And then the third one is one that you would be very happy to have a mortgage and a cat with.
Really? Oh, she's got quite a stern look, that lady.
I like them
stern.
She'll
keep you in line.
I like them stern. That's what I'm saying.
She's a serious...
Yeah. Yeah, so, I probably revealed too much of myself.
Well, that's quite good. Again. It may have been one of my favourite facts about Vaughan Oliver. I keep going on about Vaughan Oliver, but it's so entrenched in it for me, is that on the Breeders' debut pod album, it's him on the cover.
Mm.
You know, there's the weird figure. Mm. He's stripped down to his underpants in his flat. He's strapped on a belt of dead eels, enacted a fertility dance, took pictures of it, and it's really outvoked. You can't hardly see it. You just think, is that what that is? Of course, it's got Song to the Siren on it, which I think is one of the most famous, This Mortal Coil, with Liz Fraser singing the Tim Buckley song. The Syd Barrett, Late Night, I Come and Stand at Every Door, Birds. I mean, at points, it just stopped me in the tracks. I thought, I'll put it on the background at the weekend and give it another listen. And, you know, it's the thing where you're probably going to wash the floor, or you're doing something really boring, but you put some music on to make it better. But it would stop me. Mm. And I just have to listen to 3 or 4 minutes and just think, this is startling. It's so pre-irony. There's no self-consciousness about it. It's stark and it's honest. And it's incredibly serious. But I don't think that people make music like that anymore, in sentiment at least.
Yeah.
And I don't know if people could make that music now.
Yeah, I really miss the whole thing about that you mentioned before about the record label as an entity, like with Factory or Heavenly or Sarah or 4AD, you knew what you were getting. If you liked one artist, you'd like another.
Yeah.
And that whole identity is just, they don't make them like that anymore.
Mm.
No, absolutely. I used to listen to it on John Peel would be how I would have heard of it, rather than, I don't think I had any, well, I didn't have many friends, but I don't think I had any friends who had it.
Yeah.
I remember buying a couple of those albums at Virgin Megastore.
People would have, like Cocteau Twins, 12s.
Yeah.
12-inch. People were—they were definitely a thing that was around. You would see in people's houses, but actual album, like This Mortal Coil albums, I don't remember seeing them until I'd started working in record shops, and then you'd see them everywhere.
Yeah, I think in a really pompous way, it's important that this has come out I feel really, yeah, this is a really big deal. I think this music should come out more and show what 4AD was and what music was then to young people who are not interested and want to play PS4.
Is the vinyl delicious as well? Does it look and smell
it does.
Delicious?
It's really lovely. Mm. Yes, it's quite fetishistic for people who like that sort of thing. Yeah. Wonderful. Well, I think I will go back to listen to it in the sad disco on my own. I don't know.
Yeah.
And on that note, Big Mouth, I want to say we're sad to hear that Nick Rogue, the filmmaker and auteur, has died aged 90. 90, though. We wanted to delve a little bit into his world. From Performance from 1970, Walkabout, Don't Look Now, Man Who Fell to Earth, to Insignificance and The Witches and many more, Rogue did put his stamp on films and confessed that he refused to play the movie game and therefore lost out on many directorial roles by not being a massive film tart. So, we're going to listen to Memo to Turner from Mick Jagger from Performance, of course, to get us in the spirit and have a little chat.
Tonight I see you down in San Antonio on a hot and dusty night. We were eating eggs in Sammy's when the black man there drew his knife. Oh, you drowned that Jew in Rampton as he washed his sleeveless shirt. You know, that Spanish-speaking gentleman, the one that we all call Kurt.
Rob, what was the first Nick Rogue film you saw?
That would have been Don't Look Back.
Don't Look Now.
Don't Look Now. You see, that's how much it impacted on me. Sorry, Nick. Don't Look Back. What is Don't Look Back? Yeah, Don't Look Now.
Don't Look Back is the Bob Dylan one.
I feel, yeah, that's right. I put my hands up straight away and I think I probably don't need to do that and go that Nick Rogue's films are films that I have read about more than I have watched.
Oh, okay.
So I've read them. I feel that there's one of the he feels like those films where they have been so endlessly discussed that you almost don't need to watch them because it's like, well, there's a whole series of opinions about these things that you already have. Now, I mean, I've seen Don't Look Now. I've seen that. I've seen Man Who Fell to Earth, which I remember seeing on VHS when I was about 16. Mm-hmm. But have any of them left a huge lasting impression? I don't think so.
I think on filmmakers,
But then I've never even seen Performance, so I've missed out on it. I know, right?
I mean, there's going to be lots of, you know, new streaming Nick Rogue films, hopefully, on what your preferred streaming platform.
Yeah.
Hannah, you say you've seen Performance, you said earlier.
I have watched Performance purely because it was a Happy Mondays song. to see what it was all about.
Nice. Yeah.
That's how I'd heard of it. And I think Mick Jagger was gorgeous in it. I hadn't got a clue what was going on. Mm. It seemed to be two films in one. Mm-hmm. And since then I've read slightly questionable things about the females involved in making the film. Mm. There was part of me that didn't see what the fuss was about. But Mick Jagger was absolutely gorgeous in it.
I think with Nick Rogue, it's someone that you have to see a fair few of them to see the auteurness. Mm. Now, I originally saw, I think it was Performance, and then we did Don't Look Now, Film Studies A-Level at Hounslow Borough College a long time ago. But therefore, we had to then go and explore what other filmmakers would be like that and sort of try and see the threads that were in there. And I think what made him really important was he, as I say, didn't really play the game, but he also toyed with pop culture. So he's not that, you know, avant-garde in that way. He's got Mick Jagger, David Bowie, Julie Christie, obviously. Mm. The big stars that are in his films. Insignificance with Teresa Russell and all. But the themes he's dealing with are themes about reality, man, and not playing that narrative game. So you're getting cross-cutting, you're getting a lot of flash-forwards and flashbacks. So the more you see, the more you kind of see that world of his, I think. So I would say go and see Walkabout with Jenny Agutter. It's amazing.
Yeah. Actually, Walkabout, I remember seeing on
TV. Walkabout is
amazing.
Fantastic. Yeah. The first section, the first act of Walkabout is, I mean, my jaw is on the floor at what happens. And then it's the journey and it's about a brother-sister relationship. I mean, I think that he was very happy not going into the mainstream from what I can see. He wanted to be someone who was more to be discovered than someone who was out there all the time. But the fact that he can play with those the pop culture stuff and the rest of it, as said, I think made him really, really important. And it's also about perception, man, and that he does do a lot of... within the editing is what he wants to say. So you've got lots of scenes with not that much dialogue, but it's the way that you're seeing them and the way they're editing. Also, for film buffs, he uses what lots of people really, really hate, which is zooms in and zooms out.
Right.
They're really unfashionable and they're really hard to do without looking like Crossroads or, you know,
like that's
whatever,
a bad thing,
1980s.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
yeah. soap operas. So you get these lot of quite wobbly, zooming in on a face completely apropos of nothing and then zooming back out. And he really plays with that and toys with that. At first, I really hated it. And now I see it as, you know, part of his... Ooh, it's wonderful. Mm. But I say, I think to anyone who hasn't seen lots of his films, go and just do a glut and say, hopefully they will get digitised and we can all see them that way. I watched The Man Who Fell to Earth on VHS last night. Am I talking too much about how much I love Nick Rogue? It's quite... There are quite wooden bits in it, but it still has those tropes that he has. And of course, you can stare at David Bowie.
Yeah. I feel like it's a film I should see. I feel quite ashamed that I haven't. You've inspired me now.
Yeah, it doesn't all. There are bits where I feel my attention drifts off. Yeah.
There is also, but there's, you know, there's a whole other trope in there, isn't there, of just films that you sucked up as a teenager that just basically involved something to do with David Bowie.
Yes.
So, you know, there'd be all sorts of them, from Christiana F to, you know, obviously that. And, well, there's a ton of others. I'm thinking. Well, I can't think of what the one with Bauhaus in it at the start.
I know the one you mean. I can't think either.
Yeah, that one.
Listeners,
anyway,
we don't have one, Google. Fact. Don't tweet us about this. We're trying to do this with our memories. Right?
But I did film studies.
Oh yeah.
And we never even mentioned fucking Nick Rogue.
Oh, what was
it's all about Hitchcock.
Oh, okay. Yeah. We did film noir as well. Very good. We'll sort notes
anyway,
later.
There we go.
Let's have some of your music, Rob Fitzpatrick. You've hoiked in a crate of toasty hot shellac too.
Yeah.
How did you get it down the stairs?
Well, you know.
What have you brought in for us?
Merkage Dave.
Who now, is this person?
Merkage Dave. Now, full disclosure, I make a show with Merkage Dave, but I would be the first to say that is not the reason why I've chosen this track. Merkage Dave is a sort of rapper and musician and singer and songwriter and producer. He's got an album out now called Merkage Dave Changed My Life. He's a really interesting guy.
Where's he from?
He is from London and studied in Manchester. But he's a really, really, really interesting guy. And it's a very interesting album. It's got a lot of sort of, there's kind of odd pop moments on there. And there's he sort of sings and he raps. And there's all sorts of musical influences going on in there. But the track I chose is right near the end of the album. It's called Same Old Spot. And it's just, he's got a real kind of route to a particular kind of melancholy.
Right.
And they're very descriptive. You know, you very much feel that you're getting a view into what is happening in this person's life. And Same Old Spot is about being in the same old spot, in the same old situation with someone coming in and out. And it's just a great, great song. I won't be in the same old spot, my back to the wall and my hands in my pockets if you need me. Yeah. And you won't order the same old thing, cause it's all you drink. We'll be drunk coffee when you. And on to the new Michael Douglas sitcom, in inverted commas, from out of Netflix. The Kominsky Method stars Douglas as an acting coach in LA, of course, who has gloriously attentive yet forgettable students, a permanent look of resignation on his face, and is between wives. Let's have a sniff of the trailer.
So how's your love life? You're still seeing, what's her name, Triscuit?
Tristan. And no.
Oh, that's too bad. She was kind of cute.
Well, we didn't have much to talk about. You know, she was half my age.
Half your age is still an old woman.
Fuck you, Norman.
Do the math.
From the prolific Chuck Lorre, he of 2.5 Men and 1,000 Others, comes this. Michael Douglas panning about with his best mate and agent, Norman, ruminating on what it is to be an older sort of person. Rob, can you set this up for us?
As an older sort of person? Yes, I
no,
can.
No.
I really liked this, and I put the first one on, and I thought, my initial reaction was, Netflix show, blah, 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 blah. It's got that kind of Netflix music. No, yeah. And then it's, you know, it felt like, oh, here we go, it's a program for, you know, it's such an easy sell, right? We're going to do a show in LA, it's kind of about LA, it's got loads of LA landmarks in it, and LA people, and it's this thing, and it's simple, and Michael Douglas is doing it, and yeah, it's... pitch is in. However, in the first episode there's a couple of absolute gut punches that it would be a spoiler to say what they were, that it was like, fuck, that's like, okay, you've got me. And I actually have watched, I ate up the whole series. I did all eight.
Oh, wow.
I know, right?
Ooh. Okay, yeah.
I mean, it helped. Hardcore. It did help that Mrs. Rob was out of pottery last night. Yeah. So, therefore, I could
very
watch it.
Very long pottery.
It was, yeah, very long. Yeah, yeah. Should not come back now. Mm. But, no, I really liked it. I mean, it's no groundbreaker. Mm-hmm. And it is, as you said in the intro, there's definitely some of Curb Your Enthusiasm mm-hmm. in there. There's also, I thought there's some of kind of extras in there in that
right,
sense of,
yeah.
you know, there's some big names, you know, Jay Leno comes in and Danny DeVito's in. And, you know, there is a bit like get your pals in. But there is, at its heart, I ate it up. And also, 25 minutes an episode. Great. You know, rather than sort of ploughing through an hour each time and then feeling sort of exhausted by it. So, no, I really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. Hannah?
I absolutely loved it. I haven't binged something. I'm only like to episode 5 actually, so don't tell me. And I can't say the spoiler from the first episode, but it's such a beautiful portrayal of no matter who you've been, you're reaching the last few years of your life maybe, and we're all going the same way. And I think Michael Douglas is still trying to be the oldest swinger in town. I think it's really interesting how the woman, is it Nancy Travis, who's meant to be mm-hmm. his girlfriend,
yes.
who's near his age? She's clearly 20 years younger than
she
him.
She is apparently 20 years younger, yeah.
But he's still doing it. And I love the tender moments between the two friends, even though when they're ripping each other to shreds, there's still so much love there. And, yeah, there's so many good characters. I mean, it has been, I've seen a little criticism of it, of, like, painting the young people as one-dimensional mm-hmm. and they're just accessories.
Are young people 50 down, then?
Yeah, and I'd actually think that's a really good thing because we see enough TV that paints the older people as just Zimmer frame, mm-hmm. one-dimensional characters. I really like to see the tables turned, and I don't think it's unintentional. And I think there's real slapstick comedy in it when Danny DeVito is the urologist. I hope this isn't too much of a spoiler.
Yeah,
but it's brilliant.
Yeah,
he's
great.
It goes into, because there are those gut-punching moments, and then there's that, and he's hilarious. There's one, I think I can say, there's one point where he's just playing a computer game and delivering results on the phone, and he's just taking it all in his stride. And also, he's hilarious. And I think also the real slapstick character, Phoebe, who's Norm's daughter, she's
troubled daughter.
Yeah, troubled daughter. She turns up to the funeral, she passes out, she's an addict. And at one point she's trying to flog her mother's Birkin bag. And I think it's a really accurate portrayal of addiction as well. It's over the top, it's slapstick, but the heart of it is there.
I think that point about the young people, is a really good one. And I think that there is a kind of, you know, he's an acting teacher, right? Mm. And so, but I think one of the, if you wanted to look for hidden messages in it, if you're 74, like Michael Douglas is, or 75, you don't need to be taught how to act because life has taught you mm-hmm. about things. If you're 19, how the fuck are you meant to act, right? Because nothing's happened to you, you know?
Yeah.
And so you have to have someone, it's about experience. And I think that portrayal of and they are all sort of a type. And they're all keen, you know, they're all keen to learn and to do things, but they are sort of stereotypical in a way, but they're also just people who are like, you know, feed me information.
Yeah,
and
really
you have this older person
who's
trying to teach them how, but basically just trying to teach them how that, you know, life's going to bash all this stuff into you anyway. But it's like, you know, can you get a head start by being taught how to do this and that?
So it's a bit meta, actually.
It's a bit meta.
Now, my mum has joined Netflix quite recently after a few failed attempts because she couldn't get it right on the card. And I now share my Netflix with my mum. Yeah, I've said that out loud in public. And I thought, well, it's really good because she watches the other one that I can't remember the name of with two older women in it. And this is the thing. Netflix shouldn't be for 20-year-olds and people who just really think that the internet is fabulous. It's got to be for everything. And I thought that was good. However, this, I just didn't get it at all. I thought Michael Douglas' character was just too all right. He was really good at being an acting coach. I wanted to see him be not very good at some things. Yeah, he's navigating the life and death stuff. I thought some of the jokes are really off. There's some cancer sex jokes, which I don't think is giving too much away. I just thought, well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that you trying to push those buttons and be slightly provocative was working for me. I thought, great, it's a cancer sex joke. But
it's difficult, isn't it? Because I think if you're if you're in that situation, then the dark humour can help you through. But for other people, sometimes it feels uncomfortable.
Whereas Curb, I loved that and got, you know, ended up getting episode after, you know, series after series after series and watching them all in a weekend when you used to have to get things on DVD. And the darkness of that humour, and that can be really provocative and really quite odd. The Larry David stuff, I thought, was so much more Larry David than this was Michael Douglas. I thought Michael Douglas is really trying to push the envelope, but actually it's Michael Douglas, and I still see him as quite traditional, but maybe that's my... But
then you've got Basic Instinct in your head.
Yeah.
But then Michael Douglas, to be fair to him,
with the V-neck jumper,
you know, he did have throat cancer and was pilloried around the world for saying he got it through, you know, cunnilingus.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. So, that hasn't left me.
Yeah. Oh, I've forgotten about that. Now you brought it back. Yeah. Oh, no.
Well, but so, I know, I mean, I thought that, there's a kind of there, but for the grace of God, right? And that comes up a few times. And it's not so much that as also like, this is what you're looking at. And these are kind of wealthy, successful people living in a wonderful town in, you know, a nice part of the world. And bad shit happens to them. Yeah. And I think that actually their relationship with those two relationship, and I don't know if you've done the scene, I think we'll have to just admit that there's a funeral in it, will it?
Yeah.
And the funeral scene is cut. There's some brutal moments in that. I was watching it on the train, and then I was going out and getting in my car, and I just put my phone in my pocket because I was just listening to it and think, this works just as audio, right? I was watching it. And there's a bit in there where Norman stands up to deliver his wife's eulogy. And he says, you know, and she was, one of the greatest actresses of her generation. She was brilliant in this. And he goes, oh, hang on, now that's the eulogy I wrote for Sally Fields. And he goes, even at your own wife's eulogy, you're still that kind of undercutting. I thought was really good. I enjoyed it a lot.
All right. Okay. Well, I might plough on. I might do a couple more and sort of warm to these characters. You've done the whole series, then.
I've done a lot.
Hannah, you've done.
I've done about four or five.
Okay, you're going to get to
Danny DeVito and see how you feel. Yeah, I mean, it's not a huge investment. They're less than half an hour an episode.
Exactly.
I could be doing something else, quite frankly. And with that, it is the end of our show, which means closing time chatter, because we're actually pouring Bacardi into that can of pineapple Fanta I mentioned earlier and been sipping it the whole way through. As we drain the dregs of this Hawaiian-inspired cocktail, what are we frothing about? Rob, your closing time chatter.
My closing time chatter is... So, I mean, we've touched on it a lot here, I think, but it's nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
And so I find that I'm most nostalgic for things that I didn't know at the time, I didn't like at the time, I wasn't aware of at the time. And I think that for everyone, as you get older, you watch people cling to certain things in their life that meant something really important to them at the time. So, you know, it could be Vic Reeves, it could be Suede. There were lots of people talking about that Suede documentary at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Suede very fondly, but I don't want to listen to them. You know, it's like I understand where those, I think it's that thing where I understand that I like Suede and I like the Beatles and I like, you know, Eric B and Rakim, but I don't necessarily want to listen to them. It's like I've done that.
Mm.
And so my nostalgia is for things that I haven't listened to and I didn't know. You know, Hannah was talking about, you know, Five Star. Now, I'm not going to pretend that I've got a huge nostalgia for Five Star, but at the same time, but that kind of really bright, upbeat 80s soul pop really appeals to me now. Whereas at the time, I wanted to listen to, you know, The Cure.
Yeah,
right?
That's the soundtrack to my moments then. But you might just discover it now.
But those things, the things that I had just had no interest in at the time, or like, I've really got into like homemade new age music. Now, who the hell, you know, where did that come from? And so things like that, and like weird sort of jazz funk and stuff like that, and things that I just didn't
not
know.
Not Jamiroquai.
But that's also that's a function of being able to just access all this stuff, right?
Of course, because there's all this stuff to access.
Yeah, so it's not. Yeah. I'm not going out there to go and buy it. I don't want to own it.
You're not trying to sell a Spotify, are you, Robbie?
Well, I'm trying to sell the experience of just going. You could go wherever you want, and there's probably stuff that you could reinvestigate that you didn't think, you know, and you don't need to listen to all the things you thought you liked already. It's like, okay, you like that.
You've left the mish. behind.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've got a lot of love for those things, but I don't need to go home and listen to them.
So I wouldn't call it nostalgia, because you're not being nostalgic. I'd call it Rostalgia, because you're reversing it.
Yes.
Yeah, and we're going to invent this. And we're talking about
Rostalgia.
For no money. Yeah. Hannah.
Oh, my closing time chatter is, I've been thinking a lot about the state of kids' TV lately. Mm, yeah. I am finding that my children are watching it less and less. They're 6 and 9, and they're watching YouTube videos with Ronald and Karina making slime. Mm. And I think, I'm trying to look at the production values of that and think, actually, it's all right for them to be watching that. But I think that Netflix is leading the way with kids' TV. They've just brought out Brainchild, which is exec produced by Pharrell Williams.
Woo!
And I really love it. I thought, I'll sit down and watch, see what the fuss is about, because my 9-year-old's just binged the lot. Cause,
age group? Can I get my 13-year-old to watch it?
I think you probably could. I think it works. Yeah, I think it would definitely work for teenagers. Mm. I'd say it's probably aimed at your 10-year-old. Mm-hmm. But I think it's one of those things that isn't irritating for grown-ups to watch. And in the first episode, they were looking at Instagram, they were looking at how you're portrayed online, but not in a worthy way, in a why-we're-all-so-thirsty way, probably. Mm. And there are little interactive quizzes, guess which one of these got the most likes. And I just find it really good and really well-delivered. And it's very bright, it's very poppy, and I just think it's really quality TV.
I had an experience with my daughter, who's 9, recently. And I came down for breakfast. This is a warning to TV executives out there. I came down to breakfast and she was writing out this thing on a piece of paper, rather like that. And I said, what are all those names on there? And she said, those are my favourite 92 YouTubers.
Oh.
And so she, and like, those are 92 names you can just pull from the top of her head of people that she likes on YouTube, right? And I said to her, do you know what the BBC TV channels are called? And she wouldn't know. So watch out, people.
Yeah, this is what children's TV is now. It's YouTube.
This is the point where I say, we're not sounding like old people at all. I saw my son use the term original content without any irony earlier this week, and he got a lecture from me for 30 minutes. My closing time chatter is just idiotic, but it's been really getting to me, especially in the middle of the night. You know, Killing Eve has this tune when they're just about to shoot someone again in Killing Eve or do something terrible. There's a tune which is played by a band called The Unloved, who did lots of the soundtrack. It's called We're Unloved, and it's incredibly dramatic. They're using it for the ITV trailer for 2019 shows. Wow. And I'm thinking, but you can't do that. Yeah. My brain doesn't like that because that's the Killing Eve music. How did you license? And too many questions are being answered. And it led me to go back to listen to the tune so that I felt safe that tune was the Killing Eve tune. And now, though, my son plays Terminator 2 music when he's doing his homework because it makes him feel more epic. I'm now playing the Killing Eve music when I'm feeling it any way less epic than normal. And I'm thinking I've gone down a really weird rabbit hole. Yeah, if everyone wants to listen to We Are Unloved by The Unloved when they're doing something quite boring, get back to all of us to see what it's like.
Wow.
Yeah. But ITV, no. And on that note, that's it. Thanks to Rob Fitzpatrick and Hannah Verdier. What pop things are you both up to next? Any good interviews and shows and stuff?
I'm writing about X Factor.
Yay!
And how it's not the bright, shiny, lovely thing it once was. Yeah. We're limping towards the final, and who's bothered?
Oh, dear.
Mm.
And Rob, you're doing secret shows about massive UK bands.
I'm going to America next week to record the narrator for this show, who is himself a massive star.
Oh, come on, Clue.
Oh.
He's American. I'll tell you in a minute.
All right. Rob and Hannah are going to stick around for the extra bit. You can get it if you back us on Patreon. Search Patreon Big Mouth on your favourite podcast app. Or your not favourite podcast, just any podcast app. Thank you to producer Alex Rees. Thanks, Hannah and Rob.
Alex Rees from the 90s.
No,
the jungle
Alex
one.
Reece.
Okay, right. Okay.
Thanks.
He's kept himself
Trying to end it. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week. Hope the chip shop isn't closed because the pies are really nice.